total di faccio, anche se lo non do di sì in questo modo, ma sono dentro. Il punto di faccio, come è freccio, il fisico, il lingua, uscita tra di noi, quindi la vita, quindi la verità. La fine di fatto, in which order the scriptural sections should be placed in their respective compartments. We will go around in many of them, perhaps all of you have also know that there are few of them in the town and few of Russia. There are few in accordance with the children of Russia and there are few in accordance with the children of the town. I want to discuss the cheapest of the town, the children of the town. But don't get frightened. Of course, I have to resolve the problem in a lot of terms first. I can't tell you. The procedure is quite similar. And the rest, the balance of the time, I utilize for explaining the allotted studies in a practical and explanation video, which will be understandable or comprehensible for all of you. I will try to describe two basic aspects of our religious awareness, which find expression in the Shittas Rabbeinu Tam. I'm not going to make real discoveries tonight. In general, I've known to you what I have formulated differently and the emphasis may be used. Sometimes the doctrine is the same, but the emphasis. Very important. In the morning, in the morning, that's why the devil on the face, I'll express the two lines by name. In Hebrew and in general, for instance. Some of our women take that syndrome, partnership of prayer, the royalty of the apple, the mean. The royal in Shomea is made, the Shema royal in Shomea is made. The Tanya Yitre, on the Rabbi of Yitashi, from the Minish of Tore, from the Minish of Medea. So it's a very clear to see. Our Rabbi Stora, what is the order of the four scripture portions in the Tefillah Shavuot? In the Tefillah which one word that is in. The order is as follows. Kaddish, the Parshas Kaddish, little crow, sanctify unto me. The Holy King of Yaakov, the next Parsha. We are on the right. The Shema and the Royal Shemea are on the left. But there has been swapped just to the right. The Kaddish royalty and the Akos are on the left. The Shema by Royal Shemea on the right. Abaye said, this is no contradiction. For in the one case, the reference is to the right of the leader. It means the person facing the other person who wears the tilt. Whereas in the other, it is the right of the person who wears the tilt. The leader does read them according to their order. It's not important now about our lecture. It's rather where you start to diminish the right of the person who wears the tool, or from the right of the person who performs the wearer of the tool. What's important is the order in which the parishioners are placed in their respective compartments. Rashi interpreted the word cathedral, the Akeri cathedral, immediately. When reading the distortions from the leader's viewpoint or from the leader's right to his left, the partials appear in the order in which they are found in the Torah, in the Exodus, and in Deuteronomy. The leader starts with Kadesh, continues with royalty in Yaakov. Next to royalty, here Kadesh, royalty in Yaakov. Next, Shema, and at last, Goyim Shamia. We follow the order of the parshas in the Talitatut, in the Torah. Shema, Kadesh, royalty in Yaakov. You find in Parshas Bay, Exodus, Shema Royal Shemeya and Deuteronomy, in Zorin, Kadesh Royal Tirach or from first, next, Dan Shema, in which you find in Parshas Royal Chanan, and next to Shema, Dan Royal Shemeya, which you find in Parshas Eichet. I repeat, according to Rashi, the parshas are placed in the four compartments at the Tfilah Shel Rosh. The order in which the parshas are placed in the four compartments of the Tfilah Shel Rosh is identical with the order in which we find them in the Torah. Let me say again, from my right, Kadesh, my left, on the right of the leader. Kadesh, first compartment, Royalty of Yaakov, second compartment, Shema, third compartment, Goyim Shamia, first compartment. The Rabbi Natan disagrees with Rashi. He argues, if Rashi's interpretation were correct, then the Braita, the Tzadar HaKadosh the Braita, would have said, Ketat Sidron, Kadesh Nikon Prey, Vohoyim Kiyin Vako, Shema Vohoyim Shalera. But the Braita doesn't say that. The Braita expressed itself differently. Ketat Sidron, Kadesh Nikon Prey, Vohoyim Kiyin Vako, Miyimim, Shema Vohoyim Shalera, Mismor. We must assume, according to the Braita, that the continuity breaks up in the middle, between the second and the third compartment. You start Kadesh, Royalty Yaakov, and you stop. Then you start Shema from the other side, from the left, from the right. Shema, the Royalty Shomer. So according to Rabbi Natan, the order is as follows. Kadesh, Royalty Yaakov, Goyim Shamia, and Shema. According to Rashi, and the extreme right in the extreme right compartment is Kadesh, and the extreme left compartment is Goyim Shamia. According to Rabbi Natan, in the extreme right compartment is Kadesh, and the extreme left compartment is Shema. So what Rabbi Natan calls Abai is the answer. The two parshas which begin, commence with the Hoyo are in the center, in the middle. So according to the Tam is Kadesh, Goyim Kiyivahapo, Goyim Shamela, Shema. And that's how the Tam is Kadesh the Braise. Kadesh Nikopreya Goyim Kiyivahapo Minin, Shema Goyim Shamia Mismor. You start from the extreme right or left, and then you place two parshas, then you start from the other extreme, with the right or left, and you place two parshas. According to Rashi, the word cathedral is quite understandable. It means cathedral in a Persian way. In the way the text, we will find it the parts are integrated into the text of the Torah, in the same order I have to tell them in the compartments. But at Fort Rabnatam, we don't understand what the cathedral means. It was cathedral. It's not cathedral. It's Tadish Moyer Gilacho, Goyim Shomei Ashma. It's not cathedral. So what is cathedral? It is not evident, let me say, that Russian Rabnatam disagree on the basic question. How are we need to treat the four sections, the four parshia, as one entity or as two entities? Do the four parshia belong, I would say, hypothetically, to one uniform order of thought and commitment? Let's not forget that the four parshias narrate, what do they narrate for parshias? There is a spirit in the four parshias. There is a charisma. There is a tale. The four parshias narrate. What is it about? In what are the parshias concerned? People may feel should know that. Because film, according to the Rambam, is not only a mitzvah shebiyah, a technical mitzvah, but a mitzvah shebereh. It's an expiration performance as well, it's an emotion, it's a thought, it's a commitment. What is the story of the four parshas that we try to tell us? Yes? Question whether we do listen to the story. We try to tell. It's the story of Kabbalah Eim Lachu Shemayim. According to Rashi, all four parshias narrate the identical great story of Kabbalah's Eloh Hashemayim. But it's one entity, it's one unit, one order. It's one entity, one unit, one order. Then how does the order start? It has to start with the first parsha, where Mitzvah's Kilo is mentioned. This is Kadesh. We finish with the second, which entails a mention of mitzvah skill. Then we pick up the third one in a different book, in Deuteronomy, again mitzvah skill is mentioned, and finish with the last parasha, where mitzvah skill is mentioned, the Roy and Shomer. There is no doubt, it's quite obvious that Rashi holds the view that we deal with one entity consisting of four compartments, component parts, actually, consisting of four component parts, in which the reader encounters one by one the way we find them while reading the Sefer Torah. The term order cathedral, according to Rashi, signifies a technical, textual arrangement. The story contained in the four sections begins with Kaddish and ends with Moriah and Shaya. What would you suggest about our Adam? The Rabbi Natan apparently thinks differently, and he has a different view. The four parshias, according to him, to his view, represent two entities. Each entity embraces two sections. The sections from Exodus, Kadesh Moyer and Shomea, is one unit. And the sections from Deuteronomy, from Mishneh Torah, form another unit. These two units of thought and commitment are related to two orders. One order runs from the right of the reader to his left. The other order, the order of Exodus, the Exodus order, extends in the opposite direction, from the left of the river to on the contrary, excuse me, I made a mistake. One order runs from the right, from the left of the river to his right. The other order, the Exodus, extends in the opposite direction, from the left of the river to the, from the right of the river to his left. Each order has a separate point of departure. The term cathedral now for the Rabbi Adam, the term cathedral now for the Rabbi Adam, what does it signify? Not textual sequence or order. Denotes not a textual but a conceptual or experiential arrangement. There are two units, two stories, two commitments, two kerygmas, two pantheons. So one pantheon consists, this is the Exodus unit, consists of two portions. These two portions were placed in the proper order. Kaddish Moed Yerachon. Then there is another unit, with another tale, with another story, with another commitment. And there are options, and those portions are also placed in the proper order. But you start from the extreme compartment, from the compartment which is on the extreme left or on the extreme right. So that's why Kaddish Moed Yerachon constitute one order, Shema Ro'im Shemayach constitute another order. The partial extends in two opposite directions. That the residuality of content and order and commitment in film can be corroborated by another fact, namely, we could suggest it to me. Rashi seems that the order of the four parshas is a uniform, identical order. It's the same story, there is continuity, complete continuity, from Kaddish to Roya in Shomer. According to Rabbi Tam, there are two orders, two ideas are represented by the four sections. The Exodus unit represents one idea, the Deuteronomy unit represents another idea. Yeah. Or it's much like it, of course, I can't remember some of the Shinim, I believe there is a higher in support of the opinion of Rabbi Adam. So the whole lecture will be completely devoted to this problem. What are the two units of Rabbi Adam? What are the two stories that he will tell us? It's very important, not only from the philosophical viewpoint, from the viewpoint of Ashkotel, but simply for the kiyum, for the fulfillment of mitzvah kiyum. Because kiyum, in order to be mitzvah kiyum, requires not only a physical performance, but an experience, an experiential, I mean, inner performance as well. You cannot experience a mitzvah if you don't know the content of the mitzvah. So to interpret the two units of the Rabbi Natan in the proper region is of great relevance to us. I say the Rabbi Natan's opinion was that the four parshas are classified as grouped into two units, into two entities. Each entity represents a separate idea. And I say there is support for the Rabbi Natan in another halacha. Or rather, we say a kabbalah. So everyone says, correct. The Gemara says, Shin shall fill my local mission of Sinai. There is a local mission of Sinai, that Shin shall wash, the Shin should be engraved or carved. But Shin Moshe Rabbe, Moshe Rabbe is actually, this is, it's not a paper, it's a document consisting of the fiscal warfare decisions by the gaining, so they get to fill. They say, not to mention the Dhamma Paramission is here, but pushing it. Pushing it. The Shemusha Rabbe requires pushing it instead of work. The Vanda Talmud mentioned only Venshin, Shinshon Tere, the Shemusha Rabbe speaks, and added another one and speaks as two. As a matter of fact, the Shinem differ. There is one Shin on our right and there is one Shin on our left. They differ in what regard? One Shin consists of four heads and another Shin of three heads. What do the two Shin represent? What do they bear witness? What step do they bear witness? That to the duality of order and eidetic content of the world. That the Rabbi Natan emphasized so much. In order to understand Rabbi Natan, the proper idiom, to formulate his idea of classical categories and experiential terms, I would suggest that we should put Rabbi Natan's opinion for aside for one, for a short while, and instead pick up a passage in Midrash Rabbah, in Shmeis Rabbah, related to the verse, Veis Kutasa Pesach, Kol Benecho Medecha Reisei. I'll read it in Hebrew, I'll have the translation, and then our whole lecture will just revolve about the interpretation of that passage in the Midrash. The Midrash starts as follows. Yehi libi tomim b'chukecho, l'mar le'idish. Ve'chukas ha'petach. I'll read it in Hebrew first. Chukecho means two. It means two chukas. What two chukot did David have in mind when he said, Yehi libi tomim b'chukecho, let my heart be undivided to attaining your statues? What statues did he refer to? So the Midrash says, Zechutas ha'pesa, Zechutas for Adumah. Namo, Sheshteyem beinim zelodeh. Bozeh lehem ha'chutas ha'pesa, ובוזן להם רוחות הספרו. ואין אתו ידע איזה חופו גדלו מזו. מושר לשני מתונים, תאו כאן כאן כאן. דיימס, שואים האוכל שתיהם. מי גדלו מזו? איסו שחר אותו, מלווה איסו, אביסו, בלכס נחרו, גדלו מזו. כך נאמר בפסח, חוקו, ובתורו נאמר חוקו, מגדלו, התורו. שאיך לפסח צריכים לו, שנאמר ולא תחולה תומי, ואפר שבי בזחתו. Let us start with the Midrash. Let my heart be undivided, it's very important, the word tomei. In thy statutes, in order that I may not be put to shame. As a matter of fact, I told the boys to bring the translation of the prayer from the ticket. Didn't that appear on the ticket? All right. David referred to two statutes. Chukecho. Did he leave it telling the Chukecho? Two statutes. Chukecho, two. The statue of Pesach and the statue of Korah Adumah. The Rebbe said, say what to say, the phrase which I dislike. The Rebbe had to hide his mind. It's not a different story. It just is destructive by the meaning. Which are similar to one another. For in reference to the first, it says, this is the texture of the person, In reference to the other, it says, this is the statue of the Lord, Vishnuka Satyam. Moreover, one does not know which statue is greater than the other. It measures greatness of the statue. It is like the case of two ladies, noble ladies, who were walking side by side, together, apparently, on the footing of equality. Who then is the greater? She whom her friend accompanies to her house, and so is really following her. Similarly, in the case of the personnel, we find the term statue, hutasatera. Then in the case of the red heifer, we also come across the word statue. Which then is the greater? The red heifer, the paradigm. For those who eat the personnel, who participate share in the foreign person, the personal end, need eat purifying ashes. And it is said, and for the unclean, they shall take of the ashes of the burning of the fire. And in Hebrew, Rishka Shechavato, Melave Yisrael Beto, Melecha Sacharel, Tachnema Bepesach, Chuko, Vipor Nema Chuko, Migdelo, Apo, Sheikh Mepesach Trishinlo, Shenema Lokku Lakomei, Meachar Shreifa Sachatos. Do you understand it? I know it. Let us first understand the Midrash verbatim. The Chukas HaTero, for instance, last Shabbos, yesterday, we read Parashas Korach. We still have to read one. The Chukas HaTero is never that was exactly that transpired also during the time of the Israelites. First, what did the Jew do? He submitted himself to the sprinkling of the Bnei Chatos in order to clean himself. After Mishnah, correct? Then, after the absolutely the sprinkling of the Bnei Chatos, in the Zohar of Bnei Chatos, he fulfilled his duty of offering the Pesach and eating the Pesach. The Chukas HaTero is never left alone. Because one cannot fulfill the precept of Pesach without attending to the cleansing with the Mechatos. It's impossible. The Mechatos is always in the company of another Chukah, namely Pesach. After cleansing with the Mechatos, one is still pretty bound to offer the Pesach. Consequently, the Pesach or the Chukas HaPesach is only the esper or the nave. The Poraduro or the Chukas HaTero is the mistress. Do you understand me? What is difficult here? As far as sequence of time is concerned, it's correct. When you are concerned with the Chukas HaTero and the Chukas Korach, you are also concerned with what? The Chukas HaPesach. So Chukas Korach is never left alone. It's always accompanied by what? By Chukas HaPesach. While after having attended to the cleansing, with the Bnei Chatos, so I still have to attend to what? To Pesach, so Pesach is alone. So apparently, Pesach is the meat, the escort, lady in waiting, and the Huta Sapporo is the mistress or the notary. What is difficult here is that talking in terms of sequence, of temporal sequence, is correct. But analyzing the situation in a Lafis conceptual terms is the reverse, is true. Why is the reverse true? Because why do you attempt to be cleansing this mechatos? For what purpose? The cleansing with the mechatos is not a purpose in itself. It's not a mitzvah per se, an independent mitzvah. It's in order to qualify the cleansing for another performance, namely the sharing in the Holy Pesach. Then I call it, conceptually, this Pesach should be considered the mistress, the leading lady, I mean the noble lady, the queen, and the mechatos, the attendant, the escort. Because teleologically, my concern with mechatos is due to what? To the mistress guest. But anyway, I cannot argue with the Medrash. Now you have to be useless. This is the way the Medrash says. The Medrash interprets in terms of sequence in time. The sequence in time is the Torah always comes first and the form better. Yes. But let us understand. But this is not important of it. What's important to understand our problem in Medrash? Meet Ben Amizu. Who is the great one? Who is more outstanding? Who is more important? Who is more significant? What part of the Medrash? There was a philosophical problem, apparently, which the Medrash wanted to resolve. It's typical of the time in which the Medrash was written and edited. And perhaps it's also important to our time. The semantics, and I'm going to tell you something which you all know, but I told you in the beginning, I'll formulate it differently, and I'll play it against this of my ideas. But the thought itself is very old, and is known to you. The semantics of the term Kutor is according to our tradition, to the Torah Shebaal tradition. It appeared the first time, the interpretation of Kutor in the manner in which I'm going to explain in Perek Teini, quoted by Rashi at the beginning of Parshas Kutor, and by Maimonides in the last aloha of where? Last aloha of Hilchot Megillah is the semantics of Kutor in accordance with the tradition initiated by me. And the Torah is voted by all the Shema, is the following. Chukor, they sell, Rashi says the following at the beginning of Chukor, and there is almost an I, and the same one which is used by the Rambam. Chukor, they sell the precepts which the Satan and our enemies scoff at. The ridicule, saying, what is this command? And what is the reason for it? Shasotam the Unisarewa Mishivim, however. On this account, because of that, the scripture uses the term Kukor. The term Kukor, this Kukor Patero, implying it is a law ordained by me, the capital. And we have no, you have no right to examine or to criticize it. They will not have the shoes, they have it after. Consequently, so what is Foucault? Foucault is related to the absolute norm, or to the ultimate intent. Now let me see, what do we understand under an absolute norm, or an ultimate imperative? What do you understand by it? I enemies, the field of tender and the barren football, absolute norm of ultimate imperative, we understand two things. One, unalterability and universality. The validity of the hooper, of the absolute norm, is independent of situational factors. You know, we speak now of a situational attitude, or that. Whoever takes the course of philosophy knows about it. The hooper is completely independent of situational factors. Be the factor, be they, political, economic, be they sociological, cultural. The Cooper is independent of them. The transient mood of society, or the volatile intellectual climate, and the fluid value structures, all of those factors have no bearing upon the Cooper. The Cooper persists. So what? The latter is valid in all circumstances, always and everywhere. This is a description of the term hooper, if hooper is to be equated with the absolute norm, and that they are saying indeed equated hooper with the absolute norm. It means, what is the first trait of that hooper? What is the first characteristic of that hooper? What is it? Unalterability and universality. And I believe that certain worlds of feeling would describe what universality means, what unalterability means. David says, "On the English movie, Kahor, the only one for me forever. In Esak Shomayim Shomoto, the Ati Hashem, in Echot. Where shall I go from thy spirit?" And I would add one word, and from thy Sukkot. "Or where shall I flee from thee and thy law? If I ascend up into heaven, and I land on a distant star, millions and billions of miles away, thou art there, and so is your command. If I make my bed in the bottomless depths, thou art there, and so is thy precept. It is impossible to flee from God. It's also impossible to flee from His law. The law catches it. One tries to flee, it's put up. You know to whom I am. Look at it. The young man. The theological reason for this equation, which can be traced to Chazal, to Terafim. The theological reason for this equation by our rabbi, as hooper and absolute norm, is, in my opinion, the following. Chokich. In Hebrew, the verb, okay, the verb, signifies what? Carving, or engraving, or forming by incision, figures or letters on a hard, tough surface, such as metal or stone. Ein al kapayim hakeser. Kapayim doesn't mean an hour. Our hands are soft, not hard. It means that the hands are mighty, and they are pretty hard. Den auf Italien vergesse, deine Gräten, die upon the palms of my head. Schenke ki pastella mischkonle, and greatest the habitation for thyself, in the rack. Over the possibility of the meeting the apostle Milai Beit Bauzel, the Seres Loab, the two in the table. Well, if my words were now written, they were graven in rock, and the most important is this word, forever. What does it mean? A script by incision upon a hard surface is relatively protected against the destructive hard end of time. It persists, it lasts a long time, millennia. Chokak means, allegorically, to engage in legislation, permanently binding legislation of uninterrupted validity. Job says, Loach b'tzu v'yechotzeh. They should be engraved in the rock forever. So the word chotek is to be understood forever. Not just if one deals with the ancient script, they will not use the term chotek. You will use the simple term chotek. Chotek means permanently. Permanently is symbolic of us. As permanent law. Unchangeable, unalterable. The Aseret HaDibrot, the Decalogue was engraved on 2 tablets of stone. Why? Didn't the Kodesh Baruch Hu find some light on the material? Why did he charge Moshe with the mission of climbing the mount and carrying 2 heavy tablets of stone? What does the Luchot represent? The idea of stability and comfort. It's quite interesting. Once Moses was confronted with the Trinity, wild pagan dance around the golden calf, he smashed the Luchot. He broke the Luchot. Again, why? For the following reason. The people forgot the first commandment. I am thy God within 40 days. So what is the use of presenting them with this commandment engraven on stone? Since they lack the basic trait of a Jew, namely loyalty and mission. Therefore, the term chenik or chukah, it's the same, whether it's a masculine or a feminine, is related not only to the moral law, but to the natural law as well. The Bible identifies the natural law with the moral law by calling both orders, the moral order and the natural order, chukah. You are not possible, you remember our passage? Yes, correct. Okay. Rav Ritz, the Sumei Layom Kukei, who when he gave to the sea its decree, the father in Mishnah, who the Kukei made the earth, when he appointed the foundations of the earth. The reason for this equation, namely, the moral law is called Kukor, and the natural law is called Kukor, is, in my opinion, a twofold. One. First, and this is it's a simple thought, it is in my mind, it's certainly in my Maimonidean philosophy. But I will read it about death to the, it can be traced death to the Talmud, and I believe even we'll find it internationally. Nature functions in accord with a cosmic moral law. Nature as such is a moral being. Nature, I mean, in the universe, the cosmos as such, is a moral being. Whether studies more in the book, in Klimak was, I believe, I'm not going to make a mistake, 72nd chapter in the first volume of the Mayor of the Muslim, when Rambam declares the whole cosmos as Makro Anthropos, as a big, great man, as individuality, as a personality. This is supported by the Chazal Seren Tzar Leilom, the angel of the world itself. Of course, my mind is spoke in terms of panpsychism. The world as a whole, as a totality, is a living being. Not only a living being, but a moral being. And the word gravitation, according to my mind, we understand it as something technical, which is reduced to mathematical equation. According to my mind, the law of gravitation, because it is a moral law as far as the cosmos is concerned, the universe. We don't understand the transition, the transition. So, more display, that if any noise, have any noise for Sechel, means Moses, but my mind is said in the other that Moses wanted to understand the transition from the cosmic law into moral law, or vice versa, the transition from the moral law into the cosmic law. The law, the natural law which was imposed upon the universe by the Maker at creation is a moral law at the same time. God's moral law is implemented by the fall of the stone, by the rising of the tide, and by the explosion of a distant star somewhere on the outskirts of the cosmos. It's not only a mechanical performance, it's a moral fulfillment. Would you throw the process to support my mind? Is it new to you then? You look almost surprised. With the old Hebrew expression, and the Hebrew scholars, and later by the philosophers in Italy at the Renaissance, the cosmos is a macro anthropos, and on the contrary, and the man is a little cosmos. Then it goes there, this view, this can be traced back to Maimonides and to Chazal, in my opinion, to the Chumash itself. Vayara v'kir eskola asher oso v'nitei v'nei. What do you mean v'nitei? What do you mean v'nitei? Teit is an adjective which is applied to moral action, not to technical action. It's in Vayara v'kir eskola asher oso, that the whole cosmic structure, the cosmic order, is at the same, is a moral order at the same time. That's why hate is applicable to the moral law and is also applicable to gravitation or to any other physical law. According to my manners, the book of physics is the code of morality for the stone and for the electrical current and for the magnetic field. Then it is superfluous to say that nature has never violated that law. And that's why we many times have pointed out to Israel the stability which prevails in nature and the whimsicality which prevails among the people. The second reason why the natural law was Karen Schrock i Dette. Because the natural law is unalterable, there are no exceptions, no surprises. The natural law is reliable, predictable, and universal. The law preserving here, the night that you are, the countless events, and the distant star. That's why the fake, the word fake, is applicable to the moral of the natural law. Because both are unalterable and universal. This one of the things I said, I understand by the word of the Karen Cooper, by the Karen in absolute knowledge, means unalterability and universality. Completely irrelevant then and where. Now there is a second thing which I understand, which comes under the Karen Cooper, in absolute knowledge. I mean, as a matter of fact, you should tell me that. What is it? Well, what do you understand by Kutman? What do you understand by Kutman? We all know Kutman is in the Shul, Rabbi Raphael. What do you understand by him? I said one aspect I explained. The steady, stable character of the law. The changes in society have no bearing. But this is not exactly what is understood at a popular level by Cooper. What's understood by Cooper at a popular level? I beg your pardon? What? Unexplainable, all right? Yes. But I didn't hear. The second thing I understand is that total. The absolute law requires total commitment. And total commitment entails a strange paradoxical act of surrender or suspension, if I may use the Kierkegaardian phrase. But he didn't use it in this context, in this connection. Suspension of the logos, of the human logos, of the human action. The commitment to the super is total. And if it is total, it is unintelligible. I'll give you an example, the last. The commitment of a son to a father, or a daughter to a mother, is not a total one. It is qualified and depends on many circumstances. The commitment of a parent to a child is almost total. The commitment of a parent to a child is the most unintelligible commitment. And the commitment of the Almighty requires of us to his cooking should be total. And total means unintelligible. I commit myself to a rock, a law, even though this law has been vetoed many times by my reason. The cause that motivated the legislator to advise the people to comply with such a law is a mystery, remains a mystery. What the Chok demands from us, basically, what does the Chok demand for you? And let's not forget that we are rational beings. So what does the Chok demand from us, from a rational being? What does it demand? To be non-rational and to act unreasonably. Is at least an internal practice. It says what? Be unreasonable. Don't act like a rational being. A rational being has always confirmed his His reason, love is for showing the lover, don't yourself. Accept, surrender, suspend. The need of love makes trouble suspend. At this point, I wish to correct something I said just a short while ago. I said then that Hooper and Maxwell Cohen has two characteristic traits. One, unalterability. The second one, now paradoxality. Basically, there are not two traits. It's one trait, namely, what trait is it? What is it? Paradoxality. Namely, the surrender to the paradoxical and enigmatic, which the total commitment entails. As a matter of fact, that's the reason why the total, why the hawk is unalterable, because it is unintelligible. Since the hawk belongs into a non-cognitive dimension, it is not subject to change. Only worlds motivated by the intellect are vulnerable to modification and correction, or even interpretation. If a world is motivated by the intellect in general, likes to build and tear down, to create and destroy. And what is history of science? It's not a story of uninterrupted construction and destruction. Affirmation and negation. The hawk being a unique entity, free from the whimsicality of the motivational apparatus in man, can afford to be steady and persistent. In this juncture, we are faced with a very serious problem of human personalism, which plays a great prominent role in Judaic thought. Because the idea that man was created in the image of God, the woman of a day, and the idea that man is an individuality, a spiritual personality, that be given to the world by the Jews, is in light of our definition, the problem of human personalism arises. Man, tells us the Bible, was created in God's image. In other words, God dwells in man, or abides in him. And the divine presence manifests itself in throughout, through the singularity and otherness of man. In his being different from the entire customer, being different. To be human means to be different. I don't mean from a greatest wrong, it means to be different, to be existentially different, different from the animal, different from the food, different from the setting, different from the planet. That means to be human. What is singular? What is singular? Now let me ask you. What is singular in man? Or shall I substitute human for singular? What is human in man? What is the humanitas in man? What is it? Is heaven what? What reflects the divine presence within man, and what reflects dignity of man, which is a result of divine presence in man? Of course, the usual answer given is well known.
le même fait que
malgré singularity of man is, you know that, is identical with what? With the Logos, which abides in him. Oh, with the cognitive capacity of man, man is capable of his own, to acquire knowledge. The animal is incapable of acquiring knowledge. Whatever the reason be, what is the basic difference? It's this, and this was accepted by man. For instance, when the medieval philosophy classified the universe on the four categories, minerals, semen, plants, semea, hides, and then it comes to the end, they'll use the term metabel, the speech. What does speech express? Human thought. It means his rational ability, or his cognitive noetic capacity to think, as my mind has expressed himself, to think along abstract conceptual lines, to think in concepts. And it's very strange that my mother has guessed hundreds of years ago that science will speak in concepts. I am speaking about mathematics, physics. The discipline which operates concepts is abstraction, nothing else. That was the answer which was given by my mind. I mean, I want to be in trouble with my mind, but it's not up, not important at all. If this situation were true, that humanitas, singularity equals humanitas, humanitas equals cognitive capacity in man. If this were true, then man's commitment to precepts, whose rationale removes him, and whose significance he fails to grasp, would contradict his very dignity. How can man surrender his dignity, which is identical with his singularity, with his humanitas, by committing himself to a world which his own logos has vetoed and rejected? God would have never tolerated an answer such as Nasir Nishma, means total commitment, if identity as man would exhaust itself in his cognitive conceptual capacity. God would have never demanded from man to act non-rationally, since to act non-rationally means to act in a manner which is not human. And God himself created man to be human. Hence we move master rule that the highest endowment in man, which manifests the latter's humanity and imago Dei, is not the logos, what we call logos, not reason, what we call reason, but the sovereign will, the sovereign will. Our country, they are not the same evil. They are so many. Which is above and beyond man's intellectual selfhood. Are you following me? It's true. But I'll explain to you. I don't want to repeat your story. This is the central axis of my lecture. This mysterious will, this sovereign will, this will which is free. When my mind speaks about freedom of will, he doesn't mean the pragmatic will, but that there is a sovereign will which is free to make decisions without consulting the lovers. In a word, in the center of the spiritual personality, the sovereign, pure will abides, not the proud, pragmatic intellect. The human center is to be understood in voluntaristic categories, not in rationalistic categories. I am man because I am will, not man. Understand is very important, but it's next to me. Because I will, I have the capacity to will. And I can influence my will. That's what makes me mad. Not always, this is a matter of experience, not always does man, allegedly a rational being, act intelligently. Sometimes he acts unintelligently. And everybody knows what experience, such experience. If, of course, intelligibility be interpreted in utilitarian, mercantile, pragmatic terms. As a matter of fact, the most basic decisions in man's life are made spontaneously, suddenly, within a split second, in response to what we don't know exactly, to not original command which comes from within, not from without, but from within. To an intuition which goes on like a light on a far horizon in a bleak green light. Somehow, I can't figure it out, I can't understand it, I can't explain it, I cannot even explain it to myself, but I'm determined to do so. So some light on the far horizon is giving me direction and guiding. And this will, this intuitive will, defies stubbornly all attempts of rationalization or perceptualization. Decisions, for instance, pertaining to marriage, but now I say to your heart, decisions pertaining to law, following the law, or profession, choosing a profession, those are basic decisions to men. Choosing a profession, or selection of friends, those are basic decisions. Or major financial problems when they have to be resolved. Or military plans or state affairs. All those decisions are reached intuitively without addressing oneself and without addressing an inquiry, without addressing any inquiry to the intellect. Later the intellect comes and tries to explain. But he is what he told me, was he Johnny come late? He says that the intellect is Johnny come late. There is will. It's impossible to know that. In
get only to this second or third grade decisions are reached after a long, long consultation between prayer. And that always works. The intellect is sedate, slow, calculated. The intellect sees things in terms of loss and profit. To decide for the intellect means to figure out. Or to compare many alternatives. To foresee results. And this takes a long time. The will, the dynamic, the suffering, passionate, aggressive, and moves with dizzying speed. The will does not choose between two alternatives or many alternatives. It does not choose at all. There is only one possibility. Either I accept this possibility, there is no substitute. That's why his decisions are radical in nature, by nature. And very decisive. Sometimes they may revolutionize and change one's life. This sovereign will is not irrational. Then the rest of the sovereign is which abides in men above his intelligence, above the intellect, above the woman, above the moon. This will inspires and in many cases points out the path leading to deeper understanding and more exalted knowledge. The will, as I said before, blazes and illuminates the path for the logos to follow, to come and to understand at a high level. Without the sovereign will, great minds would have never made the discoveries which revolutionized science. I don't believe that the law of gravitation is a Newton, but it's a story. The story is an apple fell. All right, the story. It's a nice story, What is it indicative of? The Solomonite, the Starling, Solomonite, you know how this goes. Starling, Solomonite, you know, something like that. Not for me, all these romantic What does it mean? It means that discovery came in a split second. The seven wheel intervened and discovery came in a split second. The greatest discoveries come in a split second. Because the intellect is not so much involved as the wheel is suffering. So when the thermodynamic set, it moves on the torch with a dizzying speed. The greatest discoveries were made by the seven wheel, not by the slow intellect. So intellect is a bore. In the Kabbalistic Hasidic lingo, don't laugh, this is perhaps the center of Hasidic Chabad, I don't know. But it's not limited to Chabad. It's the Chaim Vital in the what century? 16th century New Akamadi. The Kabbalistic Hasidic lingo, in this lingo, the sovereign will that reigns supreme is called what's in Elion. The latter is a path thought. Is a path. Path thought in cognitive analysis. It motivates the intellect, but is never motivated by the intellect. It wills because it does will.
works to get something outside of the will. It wills because it does will. There is no need for an explanation. Why the sovereign wills. The mystics frequently employ the phrase when the pure sovereign will, I'm speaking now about the divine will, that the world emerged. The realization of the will is the final goal, the ultimate end. Nothing else outside of the will matters. It's an unmotivated will. It's a will which motivates others. But itself it wills. This Rotze Inelion, according to the Kabbalists, flows from Keser Elion, to the highest spirit. The crown resting on the head. If the crown rests on the head, so the crown is above Chochmah Bina, knowledge. Because Chochmah Bina Das are centered in the cerebrum, in the brain. And if I take the Keser and I put it on my skull, that means the Keser tower for the Chochmah Bina, for the knowledge. And what is the Keser? It's not one. It's not the pure sovereign will. Which will? And there is no need for any motivation. Of course, that's why the mystics spoke as to the phoenix, as two wheels of the Rotinelion, which flows from Keter, and the Rotinatapton, which flows from Chochmah Bina Das. The first one is an unmotivated will. The second one is a motivated will, by Chochmah Bina Das. Of course, the two wills, the Shteya and the Tzemes, merge into one absolute unity in the Almighty. The two opposites find their reconciliation in it. That's why they call it Retzene Yakoshet. There is no conflict as far as the Almighty is concerned. However, as regards man, the Almighty has granted him the Rotzein Atachton as well as the Rotzein Elyon, of course. The intelligible, motivated will and the unintelligible, unmotivated will. Any man, the two wills, quite often are in conflict, clash, they collide with each other. It depends upon man. If he wants to identify himself with the what's in a tartan, with the loyal will, the motivated will, then his existential experience will be utilitarian, pragmatic, practical. However, if he is out for greatness, so he has to identify himself with the supreme will, with the sovereign will, which does not move, does not reach out for any problem, for any business, for any profit. He decides because it decides. It wills because it will. The realization of the will is the ultimate end. Do you have time? Because otherwise I'll skip a little. As a matter of fact, the split man between what's in alien, the sovereign will, and the pragmatic will, is not just a Kabbalistic theory. In my opinion, the doctrine found its echo in our
faithful interest in institutions, Allahic institutions, such as a smart man. What does a smart man mean? What does a smart man mean? A smart man means overconfidence. And this overconfidence invalidates any transaction which had my consent, the full approval. I was not forced, I was not constrained to do so, there was no mistake, there was no error, but there was an element of overconfidence in his ability, in his skill, and this element of overconfidence invalidates an agreement, a contract, which had my consent. I agreed, for instance, to play cards for high stakes. I played, of course, lost. No, never mind that. Forget about the underworld. The underworld collects. The world does not collect. Why? Why should the agreement pertaining to my indebtedness to the winner not be enforceable? Why shouldn't the Aloha enforce the agreement? There was no coercion. There were no errors. No misinformation. What was wrong? What was wrong, that's Master Mekanje? What was wrong? Ah! Well, you say, you didn't want to lose, this is no excuse. This is not even mitigating circumstance. What is wrong? Let me give you another example, not a smarter. We have an institution like a Torah Sedoi. Correct? Dissolution of vow. The question is, I took up a vow upon myself. My mind was clear. I knew what I was doing. And I wanted to come in to obligate myself to clear the vow. But again, I could not foresee circumstances. And I took upon myself the vow, and I took the vow upon myself. And later I realized that the fulfillment of the vow will be a hardship to me. So I come before a Kohen or a Bezdin, and I ask for the solution of the matter. And Bezdin asked me, have you known that such and such circumstances would prevail? You would have never taken the vow to the vow. And so forth, so on, there are few questions and answers, and the vow is dissolved. What right does the rabbinic court have to dissolve the vow, which was taken by a free man, with a clear understanding of the situation? He was anxious to serve and to fulfill the vow, but later development made it either impossible or hard for him to fulfill the vow. Why is this solution granted him or absolution for it? What kind of an institution is that Torah Sedoret? Chazal say a Torah Sedoret perechim perechim ba'aliyah. There's no foundation. Nevertheless, we'll practice it. What do they mean by that? The same is about the smachter. I am agreed, I gave my concern, there was an agreement into which both parties entered, and the conditions were met. No cheating, I mean, I'm not speaking about Las Vegas, but I'm speaking about honest play. You're cheating. And still, this is a smarter mechanic. Then I'll give you a third case. The third case is Shuba, the temperance. Shuba is possible. Oh, desirable. Because, what? Well, like if I made a mistake, if the Avera committed Beshege in the state of ignorance, I understand. But if I committed a sin, I committed a crime, not because of ignorance, not because I was in error, there was an error of judgment on my part, but people I wanted to kill, I wanted to steal, I wanted to rob, And yet, if he is sincere if he has a contrite heart and is sincere in his penitential feelings, he may appear before the Almighty, and the Almighty will grant him atonement. And what is this atonement be? Hashem it kolor to yas in nishkot vaydo, the criminal deserve such consideration. But in the three institutions, as Martin, as the Rosedorim, and Shue, what is the explanation? Is there a common explanation for all of them? What is the explanation? You should say it. Because the real personality, the center of the personality, was not involved in either of those transactions. The sound will did not consent. We assume. The pragmatic will, which figures out, which whose decision is based upon motives of, profit and loss, this will told me to sign the agreement, to gamble, to don't make a lot of money. With the subtle will to the fire. So the central personality of man was not involved either in the Asmachta transaction, or in the Neder, or in Sin. Because you have to understand that the real identity of man is hidden, sometimes unknown to himself. The real genuine I did not participate in the orgy. It remained apart and beyond the pragmatic man who rebelled against his maker. Who is it? Who is the real I? The sovereign will. He hardly makes a mistake because he doesn't figure out his decisions in terms of practical law. Now, the whole Torah is a long, long, long sukkah. And our commitment to her is total in both respects, in the respect of the unalterability of the Torah. The Jew who governs says every morning among other articles of faith, an imam in the Shlomo, I believe, Shadeh Satevo, the famous letter, that this Torah will not be replaced by any other Torah or philosophy or something. We proclaim solemnly every morning the unalterability and the persistence of the Torah. Correct? And then the Jew, basically the good Jew, or the scholarly Jew, has never asked the why question, but the number of questions which a person may ask. Basically, there are three questions. One question is why, which the activity asked. Another question is how, which science asks. And the third question is what, which the religious person asks. Oh, what are you? Well, he never asked the question, why? Why Kriya Shema? Why Tefillah? Why Kashrus? Why Tavat HaMishpacha? Why Shabbat? We never asked this question. We have never asked this question why, even in face of disaster, when we were confronted with evil and distress. We have never raised the question why. One person did raise the question of why. He got no answer, but he was told not to ask this question. And instead asked the question of what? This was joking. The Jews never asked questions of why. With regard to the law, he never asked a question of why with regard to his destiny. He
Ritual erased. And the great hero then asks why. The laziness. The color of this artificial life. Why this, why that, why that? Why am I of the obligation? This is the question of the pragmatic here. But this is not a question of the subject. We've never said, let us find out what motivated a particular piece of religious legislation. When God offered the Torah to us, we did not request to be shown a symbol. We did not ask for a demonstration. The way which the sons of Esau, Ishmael, walked, demanded our immediate response, conveyed to the Almighty, was one of total commitment, namely, there was no better expression for that than this response which the Jews gave Almighty from the Torah of God, not the Mishnah. Why is it total commitment? Why does this answer consisting of two simple words that express the philosophical idea that we have explained before, public commitment, as to unalterability and as to paradoxality. We accept everything forever and everywhere. Nase will decide, the Mishnah will understand. Decision is prior. Two. I mean, to understand. This is exactly what the sovereign will require of us. To decide is to act and then to stand by. Don't make any mistake. I'm not recommending obscurantism. There are powers. We have to know. What do you do? But first, decision is reached. Then the intellect intervenes. Tries to interpret what the sovereign will has decided. Our acceptance suspended the authority of the law. That's why Chazal and rabbis attributed so much significance to the praise of Nasir the Mishnah. Chazal thought that Nasir the Mishnah was the most wonderful man that every Jew, the Almighty has bestowed upon every Jew. Two crowns upon every Jew, four crowns corresponding to Nasir. Nasir, the second crown corresponding to Mishnah. The crown of the sovereign will, the crown of the Momentus, the high one of the supreme Momentus, and the crown of Mishnah. The question is only, is related to all to the all, to the sequence. What comes first? Decision or knowledge? The Habit has always been saying, decision comes first, then knowledge. This is the secret, the mystery of knowledge.